Monster Man, special episode, The Green Knight.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and in particular, of Patreon supporter Jesse. Jesse has asked me to talk about The Green Knight. If you'd like to be like Jesse and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for other tiers. At the $1 level, you'll get monthly bonus audio content. At the $2 level, every other week, you'll get a new episode of my podcast, Patron Deities. We're just about to start a new season, and if you pledge now, you'll get to help choose what that season is about. So Jesse, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. The Green Knight is one of the main characters in a poem called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. At least that is what we call it. It is untitled in the manuscript that it comes from. It was written sometime in the late 14th century in Middle English, so it's contemporary with texts like the Canterbury Tales. This is a period when English literature, English poetry, is undergoing a literary revival as English reasserts itself as the dominant language in a literary culture that, in England, for the previous couple of hundred years, had been dominated by French. It's one of a group of poems found in a single manuscript and believed to be, although it's not 100% certain, but believed to be by the same author. And this, because we don't know who it was, this person is often referred to as the Gawain Poet, or, from the name of one of the other poems in the document, the Pearl Poet. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is an example of, I mean, it's a romance, so these are kind of tales of heroic chivalry. They were very popular in France. You know, it draws on that tradition of medieval French literature, but it is in the very characteristic English verse. Most of it is alliterating rather than rhyming, and then each stanza, each verse, ends with what's called a bobbin wheel, which is a little four-line section of rhymed verse. I mentioned that the Green Knight is a character in it, but actually, you know, the Green Knight in his Green Knight form doesn't turn up for most of the poem. He's at the very beginning and he's at the very end. Really, this poem is about Gawain and about the ways in which the adventure of the Green Knight tests Gawain's virtues, tests his courage, his courtesy, and his chastity. So the story of the poem is that on New Year's Day, Arthur and his knights are feasting at Camelot, or technically they're getting ready to feast, when who should turn up but this character, the Green Knight. And he is a huge green dude who challenges the knights of the Round Table and Arthur to a game. He says he's looking for a Christmas game. It's New Year's, but, you know, close enough. He says, we're within the 12 days of Christmas, right? He says he has a special axe, and if someone will hit him a blow with the axe, then they can have it as long as they are willing to withstand a blow from him with it in a year and a day. Arthur looks like he's going to accept the challenge, but Gawain, the youngest knight of the Round Table, and Arthur's nephew, volunteers to do it instead. He chops off the Green Knight's head, and the Green Knight just picks up his head and, you know, says, well, I'll see you in a year and a day, and leaves. At the appointed time, Gawain goes looking for him, and he winds up staying with this lord and his lady, and also with this old woman who is not named at that time, who will later turn out to be Morgan Le Fay. And the lord that he's staying with makes a deal with him. He says, I go out hunting every day, and I will give you whatever I catch while I'm hunting when I come back. But in exchange, you have to give me whatever you have gained during the day. And so the lord goes off hunting, and Gawain stays behind. And of course, while he's there, the lord's wife tries to flirt with him. And on the first day, he gives her a kiss. And so when the lord returns, he gives Gawain what he caught while he was hunting, and Gawain gives him a kiss. On the second day, she comes back, and Gawain all this time is saying, no, you know, absolutely not, but at the same time trying to be polite. And so she kisses him twice. And so when the lord comes home, he gives Gawain what he caught, Gawain kisses him twice. On the third day, okay, you're getting the pattern, three kisses, but also she tells him that she wants to give him her magic girdle, like a sash, this green sash. and she says that its magic will protect him from the Green Knight's axe. So when the Lord comes home, Gawain gives him the three kisses, but he doesn't give him the sash. So he then heads out to go and meet the Green Knight at the appointed place, the Green Chapel, and there the Green Knight prepares to give him a blow with the axe, and Gawain kind of flinches. The Green Knight makes fun of him. So the second time, the Green Knight does a fake swing, and Gawain doesn't flinch. And then the third time, the Green Knight swings, and he just gives Gawain like a teeny little cut on the neck. And he reveals that, of course, he is the Lord. It's the same guy. His name's Sir Bertilac. And he has been enchanted to do all this. And so we see that Gawain, you know, mostly lived up to the challenge, right? He did betray the deal with the Lord in a small way, you know, in one way, and so therefore he gets his little wound to show that he's not perfect, but he's pretty good. And he goes home and tells all the other knights at the round table about it, and they agree that they're going to wear green sashes from thenceforth. The Green Knight himself, well, I'm going to read a little bit of the description of the Green Knight, which goes on at length. So this is when he appears in Camelot. In fact, I have two translations of Sir Gawain the Green Knight, and I'm going to read a little bit from both of them to show you how translating Middle English into modern English can be challenging. Middle English, you know, you'd think, oh, hey, they're both English, right? But Middle English is quite different from modern English, as you'll know if you've ever tried to read, like, the Canterbury Tales in the original language. So this one's from the translation by Brian Stone. So King Arthur and his knights are sitting down to their feast. Of their meal I shall mention no more just now, for it's evident to all that ample was served. Near at hand the noise of a new fanfare gave the lords leave to lift food to their lips, but barely had the blast of trump abated 1 minute and the first course in the court had been courteously served, when there pressed in from the porch an appalling figure, who in height outstripped all earthly men. From throat to thigh he was thick-set and square. His loins and limbs were so long and great that he was half a giant on earth, I believe, yet mainly and most of all a man he seemed, and the handsomest of horsemen, though huge at that, for though at back and at breast his body was broad, his hips and haunches were elegant and small, and perfectly proportioned were all parts of the man as seen. Amazed at the hue of him, a foe with furious mien, men gaped, for the giant grim was colored a gorgeous green. And garments of green girt the fellow about, a 2/3 length tunic tight at the waist, a comely cloak on top, accomplished with lining of the finest fur to be found, manifest to all, marvelous fur-trimmed material with matching hood, lying back from his locks and laid on his shoulders, fitly held up hose, in hue the same green, that was caught at the calf with clinking spurs beneath, of bright gold on bases of embroidered silk, with shields for the shanks and shins when riding, and verily his vesture was all vivid green. So were the bars on his belt, and the brilliant set in ravishing array on his rich accoutrements. It would be tedious to tell a tithe of the trifles, embossed and embroidered, such as birds and flies in green gay and gaudy with gold in the middle, about himself and his saddle on silken work. The breast hangings of the horse, its haughty crupper, the enameled knobs and nails on its bridle, and the stirrups that he stood on were all stained with the same. So were the saddle bows and splendid tail straps that ever glimmered and glinted with their green stones. The steed that he spurred on was similar in hue to the sight. Green and huge of grain, mettlesome in might, and brusque with bit and rein, a steed to serve that knight. Yes, garbed all in green was the gallant rider, his hair like his horse in hue, hung light, clustering in curls like a cloak round his shoulders, and a great bushy beard on his breast flowing down, with the lovely locks hanging loose from his head, was shorn below the shoulder, sheared right round, so that half his arms were under the encircling hair, covered as by a king's cape that closes at the neck. The mane of that mighty horse, much like the beard, well crisped and combed, was copiously plaited, with twists of twine and gold, twinkling in the green, first a green gossamer, a golden one next, his flowing tail and forelock followed suit, and both were bound with bands of bright green, ornamented to the end with exquisite stones, while a thong running thwart threaded on high many bright golden bells, burnished and ringing. Such a horse, such a horseman in the whole wide world, was never seen or observed by those assembled before, not one. Lightning-like he seemed, and swift to strike and stun. His dreadful blows, men deemed, once dealt, meant death was done. Yet hauberk and helmet had he none, nor plastron, nor plate armor proper to combat, nor shield for shoving, nor sharp spear for lunging, but he held a holly cluster in one hand, holly that is greenest when groves are gaunt and bare, and an axe in his other hand, huge and monstrous, an axe fell and fearsome, fit for a fable, for fully 40 inches frowned the head. Its handle base was hewed in green, in hammered gold and steel. The blade was burnished bright with a broad edge, acutely honed for cutting, as keenest razors are. The grim man gripped it by its great strong handle, which was wound with iron all the way to the end, and graven in green with graceful designs. A cord curved round it, was caught at the head, then hitched to the haft at intervals in loops, with costly tassels attached thereto in plenty. On bosses of bright green embroidered richly in he rode, and up the hall, this man, pressing forward to the platform, no peril fearing. He gave no one a greeting, but glared over all. His opening utterance was, "Who and where is the governor of this gathering? Gladly would I behold him with my eyes, and have speech with him." He frowned. He studied the standers by and rolled his eye around, essaying to espy the noble most renowned. Right then. And just as an example, I'm going to read you the same last stanza from the translation by J.R.R. Tolkien. "And yet he had not a helm nor a hauberk either, not a pisan, not a plate that was proper to arms, not a shield, not a shaft for shock or for blow, but in his one hand he held a holly bundle that is greatest in greenery when groves are leafless, and an axe in the other, ugly and monstrous, a ruthless weapon aright for one in rhyme to describe. The head was as large and as long as an ell wand, a branch of green steel and of beaten gold, the bit burnished bright and broad at the edge, as well shaped for shearing as sharp razors. The stem was a stout staff by which sternly he gripped it, all bound with iron about to the base of the handle and engraven in green and graceful patterns, lapped round with a lanyard that was lashed to the head, and down the length of the haft was looped many times. And tassels of price were tied there in plenty to bosses of the bright green braided most richly. Such was he that now hastened in, the hall entering, pressing forward to the dais, no peril he feared, to none gave he greeting, gazing above them, and the first word that he winged, 'Now where is,' he said, 'the governor of this gathering, for gladly I would on the same set my sight, and with himself now talk in town. On the courtiers he cast his eye, and rolled it up and down. He stopped and stared to espy who there had most renown.'" So you can see that while the basic structure of the two stanzas is the same, the translations differ in a lot of details, because it's hard to convey the meaning of the poetry while simultaneously maintaining its form. Note also that Tolkien uses a lot of sort of consciously archaic language that's maybe closer to the Middle English text, but it has this feeling of being old-timey, which I don't know that, you know, the text would have had for its readers in the 14th century. So, that's a long description, but I'm going to return to it, and I think that there are a lot of interesting points about it. So what do we know about the Green Knight? Well, we know that he's a man, Sir Bertilac of Haudesert, and he is enchanted into this form. He tests the virtue and valor of knights, and he is a very gaudy character, right? We get a lot of description, not just of him, but indeed more of his clothes, his horse trappings, his weapon. And this is a society that is very conscious of that kind of display. It's been observed, I think I read this in Sarah Stanbury's section about the Gawain poet in the Cambridge Companion to Medieval English Literature, and she calls the Gawain poet someone who is very alert to the details of the material world. And if it wasn't Sarah Stanbury in the Cambridge Companion to Medieval English Literature, it was Tara Williams in Middle English Marvels. But essentially, the Gawain poet is very focused on like material culture and gives a lot of descriptions of objects, maybe more so than other contemporary writers. The effect that this has is that the Green Knight is outlandish and uncanny, but still recognizable. He's green, but he's a Green Knight. And he has a lot of the things that would be signifiers of high status and of nobility for the audience reading or listening to this poem. But on the other hand, he also has these weird things like holding a holly bough. You know, he has some signifiers of being wild, like a big bushy beard and long hair. Now, the story of how he became enchanted is not all that detailed in the poem, but that's because he's not really the point. He's there to test Gawain. So, I want to have a little sidebar to address a comment that you will sometimes hear, the idea that the Green Knight is some kind of quote-unquote nature spirit. People often associate him with an architectural motif from the Middle Ages called the Green Man, which they also aver as some kind of nature spirit. I'm not 100% convinced by that argument about the Green Man, and I'm not convinced that the Green Knight is an example of the Green Man, other than that he is a man, and he is green. Now, the story of the Green Children of Woolpit is not recorded in Middle English. I think that text is in Latin, and it's a bit earlier than this one. But it does seem to be this signifier for being kind of otherworldly and uncanny. You know, because people aren't green. People's skin and hair comes in a lot of different colors. Some people have red hair, blonde hair, black hair. but nobody's got green hair in the Middle Ages. And this idea that the Green Knight is like a nature spirit and he has sort of pagan origins, I don't think that that is a commonly held view among people who study medieval English literature. But I do think that this analysis contains an important idea, so let's dig into it a little bit more deeply. See, I think people have a tendency to look at a lot of medieval art and literature and see in it things that don't correspond to their idea of what Christianity should look like, and they therefore conclude that this is pagan, rather than thinking, huh, medieval Christianity is a bit different than I thought. And furthermore, this isn't helped by the church's attitude in some periods of history. So to give you an example from the era that I study, which is kind of England up to about 1100, the word heathen, the Old English word that is the ancestor of the modern word heathen, is used by church sources to describe things that we would not necessarily consider to be quote-unquote heathen. So for example, one text describes an unbaptized child as heathen. So for instance, there's a source that talks about how monks should not be listening to the heathen songs of the laymen. And people have interpreted that to mean that people are singing songs that have pagan religious content. But that doesn't seem to be how heathen is being used by these sources, right? They're condemning everything that is not explicitly religious as heathen. So if you look at like a Fast and the Furious movie, it's not Christian, but it doesn't mean it's pagan. They're using it to mean everything that's not explicitly part of the church. You know, you should be listening, the monk should be listening to the Bible or whatever. It means something more like secular. And I just think that medieval Christians had a worldview that encompassed a lot more kind of strangeness and magic than we give them credit for, but that does not make them pagans. Now, there obviously are medieval stories influenced by pre-Christian belief systems. For example, there are lots of stories that are adaptations of classical literature, right? Another of the most famous Middle English Marvel stories is Sir Orfeo, which is a telling, a very, very different telling, of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Or Gawain and the Green Knight begins and ends with references to the Iliad. But for the most part, I don't think that there's any evidence to suggest that this reflects an actual alternative religious belief. I think medieval Christians probably believed in magic and in fairies, and I think they definitely liked reading and listening to stories about magic and fairies, but that doesn't mean that they weren't Christians. So the Green Knight is a fantastical character, certainly, but I don't think that that ipso facto makes him not a Christian character, particularly in a story that is otherwise shot through with religious imagery and was probably written by a priest. But apart from the question of how we interpret that point, I think that there is some truth to the point itself. Bertilac embodies a magical world, and it is a world that is uncanny to Gawain, but that fundamentally cares about the state of his soul. And that may be why the supervillain plan explanation is so unconvincing, because it doesn't really matter. What matters is that Bertilac represents the way in which an unnatural world, a world that is strange and outside the familiar quote-unquote magic of Christian religion, that world is compellingly interested in Gawain's spiritual decisions. So, okay, that's enough literature sidebar. How do we use the Green Knight in games? So I think that there are a couple of different ways that we can do this. First, the Green Knight focuses on the ideas of courtesy and chivalry, of keeping your word to your host. Gawain rocks up and stays in the house of some obvious weirdos because that is the courteous thing to do and they are courteous to him. The Green Knight shows up at a feast and challenges people to an axe chopping game, and everybody's okay with this. And this is a facet of romance literature, and it's not limited to medieval Europe, right? This is something that you see in historical adventure fiction from other eras. So think about like the Three Musketeers or things like that. Or look at, for instance, The Water Margin. In the classic Chinese novel, The Water Margin, we get this prizing of courtesy and good manners and good breeding among the heroes. And this is sort of one of the things that makes Sung Jiang stand out as a moral paragon, which certainly not his actions and his overall sense of honesty, but his sense of kind of gentlemanliness and the way that he treats other people like gentlemen, you know, makes him like a protagonist, even though he's not the fighter that ruffians like Li Kuei or Lu Jixian are. They are more obviously kind of martial heroes, but they're not heroes like Song Jiang because they're not as gentlemanly as he is. Now, this is something that can be tricky to instill in a fantasy game because you don't want players to have to read and remember a bunch of fantasy etiquette. I remember the first time that I played Legend of the Five Rings. Like, a lot of the time, I would be faced with a social situation, but I don't know what the correct thing for my character to do is, either in feudal Japan or fantasy feudal Japan, but my character would know. So a lot of the time, I'm just saying things like, okay, well, I do whatever's appropriate. But I, the player, don't know what's appropriate. So monsters who are courteous are a good way to introduce this idea without forcing the PCs to know a bunch of etiquette rules. If we say, you know, that they are gentlemanly rather than that they follow the rules of courtesy, impress that through the monsters. Like when the PCs encounter the Death Knight, who, you know, has taken over this fort and challenges everyone who comes by to a joust, but he's super polite and nice. He's just also got to joust him. You know, maybe he even pays them compliments. He asks who they are. If he's immortal, so he knows, well, he's dead, but he's, you know, he's eternal. So he knows who their great-grandparents were. Ah, you know, to think that I will have the honor of jousting against the granddaughter of such a great cavalier. It is a shame that I will have to kill you. You know, when they turn up, particularly like, and that way you can distinguish those attitudes of different cultures to each other. So, you know, maybe, I mean, to use a classic D&Dism, right? Wood elves are friendly and hospitable and spontaneous, but maybe not very formal, whereas high elves have this profound sense of courtesy. Though I think actually, like, wood elves probably still have that courtesy, but maybe halflings don't. This is something that crops up in The Lord of the Rings, too, right? Like, people all sort of recognize that hobbits have good manners, and hobbits being kind of, like, not necessarily polite, but, like, friendly in a dignified way, actually sort of gets them into the confidence of people that otherwise would not admit them to that confidence. You don't have to be specific about rules, but it is a good way to try and move interactions with the NPCs from the tactical to the cultural. Now, the crucial thing is, if you want this to happen, you cannot use it as a way to betray the PCs too often. The PC's natural reaction to encountering a monster that's being polite to them would be to be paranoid and wary, and you're going to reinforce that with a sense of betrayal. So you can have a monster under these circumstances betray the characters, but you can't do it too often. Secondly, foes that are enchanted. You know, I like the idea of a recurring villain who is, under normal circumstances, a regular person, but to whom something happens that turns them into an antagonist. You know, Sir Bertilak becomes the menacing figure of the Green Knight because he is enchanted. This gives you a villain that fulfills multiple roles. It gives you a villain where information is revealed to the PCs in stages. It gives you a villain that is sympathetic, and it gives you a villain that can pose procedural or strategic challenges as the PCs, you know, have to work out how to defeat the Green Knight without hurting Sir Bertilak, or figure out a way to break the curse or end the enchantment. It's kind of weird that you don't see this in D&D more frequently. That's not even a big part of lycanthropes, even though it is a big part of the modern lycanthrope fiction, although not particularly the lycanthrope legend. Like, it's true for a bunch of Spider-Man villains, and, you know, a lot of the time, if you want to think, like, how do I get some character-driven drama into my otherwise procedural heroes and villains narrative, the answer to that question is, well, how does Spider-Man do it? Now, I kind of wonder if this trope of the enchanted foe reflects the fact that in an era when conflict centered on often non-ideological disagreements between a relatively small, like, aristocratic military class, sooner or later you were going to wind up fighting people that you personally liked and respected. Maybe not. I mean, it seems like having to fight people that you like and don't want to hurt is a pretty common story element in lots of different tales. Third, moral content. I'm a little ambivalent about this one. I think this is a bit tricky because I think that the strict moral framework of Gawain and the Green Knight, although it does have that element of like, well, you kind of messed up, so we'll acknowledge that. Like, I like that. And I think that there's room for doing something like that in a D&D game. But in general, I feel like players object to that kind of moral prescriptiveness. Like, you can have it be something that happened to somebody else, you know? Oh, because he failed in this challenge, the gods cursed him and turned him into a werebore or whatever. I can see that, but you want to be real cautious applying that logic to the PCs. One thing you could do is have that, like, morally active universe be another plane. So, on the Brine Material plane, you have normal moral agency like anybody else, but when you go to Fairyland, not just the fairies, but kind of the universe, is judging your virtues. And also, I like that the virtues being kind of relational, being ethical, that's quite like a fairy. A fairy would expect you to keep your deal with them, even if the outcome of keeping that deal was not what anybody was expecting. Fairies like to be treated fairly, if that makes sense. You go to Fairyland and the fairies are always like challenging you to weird games or asking you to engage in weird contracts with them. And if you don't do that, they start to think that you're a little bit suspicious. These are things that normal people do. Finally, the introduction to this poem. The PCs are at a feast when an uncanny foe rides in on a horse with a big axe and a sprig of holly in the other hand and challenges people to a beheading contest. That's fantastic. You know, PCs don't spend enough time at feasts, right? This introduction works if it's not that weird for you to hear a lengthy description of King Arthur's feast. Like, it's 5 or 6 stanzas long, the feast description. So yeah, send PCs to celebrations and have them interrupted by a giant strange guy coming in and offering an enigmatic challenge. I also like that everybody is shocked by the strangeness of the Green Knight, but nobody is curious about it. Nobody wonders, how did he get that way? Where did he come from? Why is he so green? Everybody just thinks like, yeah, guy's a fairy or something. I'm okay with that attitude. So I don't think that you're going to want to put, for the most part, I don't think that you're going to put the Green Knight per se in your role-playing games. Like, I don't think it works like that. I think what you want to do is evoke the same sense of the combination of the familiar and the uncanny, where the Green Knight is a strange, uncanny figure, but at the same time, he's also this, you know, he is a knight, and he asks you to do something that is kind of in keeping with the rules of chivalry. And, you know, the fact that he is a giant green weirdo doesn't change that. And I think if you aim for that intersection, you can produce really interesting monsters. And it's good because it kind of violates one of the assumptions of traditional D&D, which is that you kind of have this civilized world of, you know, humans and other humanoids and towns and castles or whatever, and then you have an out there, a menacing wilderness. And this is very much the idea, was it 4th edition that had that, like, points of light concept? But it's also the idea that you see in a lot of kind of westerns. And the Green Knight, by partaking of both, by being a civilized man who is also obviously an uncanny creature, makes that more interesting. All right, that's about all the Green Knight that we have time for today. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to sponsor your own episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or you can pledge at a lower level or not pledge at all. If you don't want to pledge at all, but you still want to support the show, one thing that you could do that would be really useful would be to leave a rating and a review on the podcasting app of your choice or recommend the show to a friend. So Jesse, thank you so much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. In our next episode, we're going to be looking at our final monster from Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for Basic Dungeons & Dragons. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.